Hi, it's Jeremy Hobson. Thanks for listening to Here and Now. There are thousands of podcasts out there. You chose this one. It's your thing. Listening choices are a part of who you are. The choice to support your favorite NPR programs is yours, too. Visit donate.npr.org/now to donate to your station, then share why that's the kind of person you are. Tweet or create a public Facebook post with the hashtag WhyPublicRadio.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and we should have the final language of the Republican tax cut bill later today. The plan cuts corporate and income taxes and limits some popular deductions. It'll increase the child tax credit in order to get the vote of a key holdout, Florida Senator Marco Rubio. And President Trump predicted Republicans will have the votes to pass the bill.
I think that we are going to be in a position to pass something as early as next week, which will be monumental.
Mike Regan is senior editor at Bloomberg News and joins us now. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Jeremy.
And does it look like they have the votes?
Well, Kevin Brady of the House Ways and Means Committee came out today and said he has all the signatures he needs in the House, and he thinks that there will be enough votes in the Senate to pass it. However, it's not obvious that that's totally clear right now. There are still some fence sitters in the Senate, and there's still the issue of John McCain is away from the Capitol for cancer treatment. Now, they expect him to come back and make it for the vote, but it's not enough really to say it's quite a slam dunk right now, but it does look like it's getting close.
But once they come out with this final text later today, can they make changes after that? Are we going to see handwritten notes on the side of the bill as we saw with the bill that passed the Senate?
I mean, it's a great question. I doubt that they will do the handwritten notes this time just because there was such enormous controversy and criticism over that in the Senate bill. However, they obviously want to rush this bill through before Doug Jones, the Democrat who just won the Alabama election, gets sworn in, which would be at the end of the month or early January. So there is Obviously, a big urgency on the part of the Republicans to get this through. I don't know if they'll amend it in handwriting again, but I'd be surprised if they do.
Well, one of the issues that came up for not just Marco Rubio, but also Senator Lee of Utah is the child tax credit. What was done in the end, or do we know, to the child tax credit?
Right. So the way the child tax credit works is that taxpayers previously received a $1,000 tax credit for each child. This reform would actually increase the credit to $2,000. But the way it works is if your income is so low that you don't pay any income taxes, you still get a refund based on this credit. And originally, the plan was to cap that refund at $1,100 per child. This compromise to sort of win Marco Rubio's support lifts that to $1,400.
Hmm. And what about the issue of individual income taxes? Senator Susan Collins of Maine has said in the past that she does not want to reduce the top income tax rate for the wealthiest Americans from 39.6 to 37%. Is that likely to change?
Well, Susan Collins certainly is adding a lot of drama to these negotiations. She said yesterday that there's a lot of rumors about what's in the bill, and she wants to take the weekend to read it. And we haven't heard anything from her since then to indicate that that's not still the case. But the way I look at it, these negotiations are like a game of Jenga. You know, you pull a block out of somewhere, and you have to worry each time over whether it's going to cause the whole thing to collapse. So if they were to bend to her wishes on that top tax bracket, it makes you wonder if they might lose some votes elsewhere. So it's obviously a very delicate negotiation. I haven't seen anything today to suggest that they would really bend to her wishes on that tax bracket, though.
Now, they do have to stay within certain budget rules in order to get this passed with just 51 votes in the Senate. How does that affect what's going on?
Well, it's a much bigger effect on the Senate because their budget rules are a lot more strict than the House. And the big number that we've been talking about for weeks now is that $1.5 trillion over 10 years. And it's caused the Senate to want to sunset a lot of the individual tax breaks. In other words, have them phased out over time. And the thinking there is that any Congress in the future is unlikely to allow those sunsets to happen. But, you know, it's really gambling on the makeup of the Congress in the future to assume that's going to happen.
But it's that $1.5 trillion. That's how much they can add to the deficit over
10 years. That's right. That's the main sort of number they're watching in this.
One more thing I wanted to point out, which is that it appears that the loosening of rules that tax exempt organizations such as churches could endorse political candidates, that got taken out of this bill.
That got taken out of it. That was in the House version of the tax bill. It was not in the Senate version. It was something that Democrats pushed back very strongly against. Obviously, they feared sort of in the evangelical community a lot of endorsements of Republican candidates. So Right. They were able to keep it out of this reconciled bill. It's a win for them, as the Washington Post described it. It's sort of a minor victory, though, considering everything else in the bill.
I have a feeling we're going to have a little more drama before this is all over, but we'll be watching. Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
So yesterday, the FCC, led by Chair Ajit Pai, voted to repeal net neutrality, and social media howled. The rules prohibited broadband providers from blocking websites or charging higher fees for different content. As It's Adam J. Smith tweeted, "I swear, it's like the Republicans are trying to lose the midterms." Also trending this week, backlash to that poignant video from a bullied Tennessee middle schooler. And filmmaker Morgan Spurlock's outing himself on Twitter as a sexual harasser, giving new meaning to the Me Too hashtag. Femi Oke, host of Al Jazeera's The Stream, is with us to look at the week in social media. Hi, Femi.
Hello there, Robin.
And start with net neutrality, an overwhelmingly negative reaction to getting rid of the neutral part.
Absolutely. And there is a hashtag net neutrality, and it has its own Twitter icon, which is when you know that an online campaign has a lot of supporters and a lot of debate and conversation going on. Netflix US tweeted almost immediately, "We are disappointed in the decision to get net neutrality protections that ushered in an unprecedented era of innovation, creativity and civic engagement." They are very disappointed.
But even before the FCC vote, Chair Ajit Pai released a video on the Daily Caller, where he dresses up in costumes and tries to convince consumers that the internet as they know it will not change. It has music, dancing, special effects. Let's listen to a little.
"Here are just a few of the things you'll still be able to do on the internet after these Obama-era regulations are repealed. You can still gram your food."
Reference to Instagram there. How was that received?
The video is called "Seven Things You Can Still Do on the Internet After Net Neutrality." And you said, Robin, things got even stranger. No, this is typical Ajit Pai. He is a character, to say the least. I would say putting out that video before the final FCC vote, that shows some confidence. Ridley Alexander says, "This man angers me to my core. He makes light of the situation and he honestly believes that he is very funny." And Stuart Elliott says, "The video is mean and clueless, and he's, as well as being a dope, the FCC chairman Ajit Pai makes jokes video mocking opponents of the vote." In that video, there's some music that he didn't get permission to use, and also a personality that was well known for Pizzagate. You may remember that conspiracy theory involving Hillary Clinton during the presidential election campaign. So a whole lot to complain about in that video, which was supposed to help people understand what net neutrality and the loosening of the regulations might actually mean for all of us users.
Right. Well, it's also a cautionary tale about putting yourself on social media. And let's take a look at a story that also represents that. We remember last week the 11-year-old Keaton Jones from Tennessee. He and his mom, she took the video. It was his idea. This poignant video after he was repeatedly bullied at school.
"People that are different don't need to be criticized about it, because it's not their fault."
Oh, heartbreaking. Overwhelming response. Just remind us a little.
Yes, it hurts to even listen to this, Robin, and it's no wonder that it went viral. It jumped from Facebook to Instagram to Twitter. It went viral very quickly. Immediately, friends of the family said, "This is the sweetest boy ever. No reason people should ever treat him this way." Katy Perry, Justin Bieber, Snoop Dogg, politicians, sports stars from around the world all weighed in his support. And then online sleuths started to do a little bit of digging. They had a look at the mum's Facebook page and they saw her posing with a Confederate flag. They they looked through some of the posts and they decided, looking through those posts, that perhaps she may be racist. Mm. And perhaps this is why little Keaton Jones was being bullied at school, because of his approach to diversity in the US, to put it lightly. So then there was a turn, a lot of pushback from people who reacted like you and I did to that initial crying little boy, and people wondering, maybe we've been had.
Look, the
crowdfunding was actually raised. Over $50,000 was raised for him, and not necessarily connected to the family. So lots of things went awry with this initial empathetic response to this little boy who said he'd been bullied at school.
Look, the mom went on CBS to say she'd actually been bullied because she is not a racist, and so that still unfolds. But I just want to make sure in the minute we have, Morgan Spurlock, best known for Super Size Me documentary, tweeted earlier this week, "I am part of the problem," and included a link to an essay about how he'd harassed women in his office, serially cheated on every partner he'd ever had, got out, and he wanted to get out ahead of this. Some people said, well, he's just trying to get out ahead of being, you know, outed by someone else. But how'd that go over in just the few seconds we have?
A big debate between, was he being brave or was he not being brave? Jose Rosado says, "You, sir, are not part of the problem. You are the problem. A decent person wouldn't do what you did." And then other people are saying, at least he came out and talked about it. He confessed openly, and that conversation goes back and forth. If you look for Morgan Spurlock online on Twitter, you can actually follow that debate right there.
Femi Okeh, host of Al Jazeera's The Stream. I think people are going as we speak. Thank you.
But you can listen at the same time. Don't go away. Here Now continues.
Thank you.
A little-known drug discount program has become a financial lifeline for the country's struggling rural hospitals, and now it's likely to be scaled back dramatically. Bram Sable-Smith of member station KBIA takes us to a hospital in the poorest county in Missouri that could be hurt by the cuts.
The Pemiscot County Hospital would be broke and closed right now if it weren't for a handful of local pharmacies like this one, owned by David Green in Steele, Missouri, just 8 miles from Arkansas. It's smack in the center of this 2,000-person town, on the corner of Main Street and U.S. Highway 61.
We used to have a blinking red light right there at the four-way stop. And so everybody said, well, go to the blinking red light, and there's the pharmacy and the bank and the Piggly Wiggly and the community center. everything you need is right there.
Piggly Wiggly, by the way, is a grocery store located mostly in the south. Green's Pharmacy buys some of its drugs from the Pemiscot County Hospital. That's because the hospital participates in a federal drug discount program called 340B that allows it to buy medicines at a steep discount from drug makers, sell it to pharmacies, and pocket the difference. Green says that doesn't really affect his business, but it has a huge impact on the hospital.
My biggest incentive is to help the hospital.
And help the hospital, it has. In 2016, the first full year Pemiscot participated, the program netted the hospital $1.6 million. That revenue played a big role in turning the hospital around after it lost $3 million in 2013 and nearly shuttered. And it's not alone. This discount program has become a critical source of income for rural hospitals across the country. But representatives of the pharmaceutical industry are pushing back on the growth of the program. Lori Riley of the trade group Pharma says when the program was created in 1992, it was meant to help patients afford drugs. But as the programs expanded,
there's not necessarily evidence that that money is getting used to benefit patients.
By Pharma's count, the program has swelled from 50 participating hospitals to about 2,400, and from 34 pharmacies to 43,000. Of course, Riley says, some hospitals like Pemiscot County are open today because of the program, but others might be taking advantage of it.
Your local hospital in Missouri is participating, but so is Cedars-Sinai in California, which is Hospital to the Stars.
And the Trump administration agrees there's need for a change. In early November, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid finalized a rule that would reduce funding for hospitals in the program by $1.6 billion. It's not as big a change as the pharmaceutical industry wants, but it would have a big impact on hospitals, particularly the rural hospitals that have come to rely on the program. And Ted Slavsky of the organization 340B Health, which represents hospitals that participate, says that will affect communities' access to health care.
clinics would close. Some hospitals may have to close their doors altogether. It is a very counterproductive proposal.
The American Hospital Association has filed a lawsuit to stop the rule from going into effect on January 1st. Even if that lawsuit fails, some rural hospitals would be shielded from the cuts, at least for 1 year. But not all of them. And the Pemscott County Hospital would not be shielded. That means it could be losing a critical source of revenue. But pharmacist David Green says keeping the hospital open is vital for the community.
I feel like it's an important thing because when people need emergency services or whatever, it's good to have one locally or close because a lot of people don't have good transportation to get too far.
So, while it can, his little pharmacy will do its part to help. For Here and Now, I'm Bram Sable-Smith.
And Bram's story comes to us from Side Effects Public Media, a news collaborative covering public health. Well, it's the time of year when a lot of TV channels are in full-on Christmas special mode, and NPR's TV critic Eric Deggans joins us now to talk about some of his favorites. Hi, Eric.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
And first of all, let's get the bad out of the way first. You say a lot of this stuff that we and many people will be watching on TV this holiday season is too hokey and has other problems. Why? What's wrong?
Well, of course, we all know about the Christmas specials that are sort of disguised exercises in corporate synergy or ads for toys. I want to save sort of specific and sustained criticism for the Hallmark Channel movies. Hmm. And these are favorites of a lot of people, including my mother, so I hope she's not listening. But, you know, the Hallmark Channel has these made-for-TV movies about Christmas. If you go to their website, you can see posters for every one of them. And when you see these posters and you look at the people depicted on them, they're always depicting couples or family groups. You will see just 3 out of 21 movies that feature at least one person who's not white. Huh. And of those 3, you will see that 2 of those movies feature the non-white people in sort of secondary roles. You know, these are movies that are very much focused on a certain way of celebrating Christmas. It's often suburban, it's often middle class to upper middle class, and it is very white. So, you know, a lot of problems that I have with really badly made Christmas specials is stuff like that. When the idea of what Christmas is that's reinforced is something that's exclusionary, something that feeds into stereotypes, that's when I really have a problem.
Well, and it makes me think of 2 of my favorite Christmas movies that I'm sure are going almost every day on TV right now are Home Alone and Christmas Vacation, both of which feature, you know, white families in the suburbs.
Exactly. And I do sort of feel like those movies were made quite a while ago.
Right.
But, you know, Hallmark Channel was churning out movies like right now. In today's times, in 2017, what a family is incredibly different, incredibly diverse. And so there's no excuse for contemporary movies to lack that level of diversity. And what I think makes a good holiday special, and I'm not talking about stuff that was made a long time ago, because that stuff has nostalgia. And of course, we look back on the stop motion stuff like, you know, Frosty the Snowman and Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. But, you know, modern holiday specials have a sense that they're making fun of the hokiness that is inherent in a holiday special, right? And that leads us to talk about a holiday movie that I really like.
Which is, we'll just play a clip and people can figure it out on their own. Here it is.
Ralphie, what would you like for Christmas?
Horrified, I heard myself blurted out.
I want an official Red Ryder Cup in action 200 showings while air rifle.
Ooh.
No. Shoot your eye out.
Oh, no. It was the classic mother BB gun block. You'll shoot your eye out.
You'll shoot your eye out. That, of course, from A Christmas Story, the 1983 classic. What do you like so much about this, Eric?
Okay, so number one, you can just sort of enjoy the actual story, which is built around this kid named Ralphie, who's having Christmas with his family in Indiana. It's a fictional town, but it's based in Hammond, Indiana, which is, you know, just a hop, skip, and a jump from where I grew up in Gary, Indiana. And this kid, you know, he wants his BB gun. And so that story, if you just take it at face value, is wonderful. But there's also a sense that this movie is having a lot of fun with all the weird stuff that happens at Christmas between mom and dad and between siblings and the weird rituals that we have, you know, the family feast that we have and the weird stuff that dad does. You know, Darren McGavin plays the father here, and he's mostly referred to as the old man. And the old man has all kind of, you know, weird rituals and things that he does that make the Christmas season kind of interesting and absurd. And the yeah. film just feasts on that.
And by the way, Fox is doing a live version of A Christmas Story this weekend featuring Matthew Broderick and Maya Rudolph. So we'll have to see how that goes. Meanwhile, Eric, you have another favorite, The Grinch from 2000. This is the Jim Carrey adaptation of How the Grinch Stole Christmas. Let's listen.
Never those who's inviting me down there on such short notice. Even if I wanted to go, my schedule wouldn't allow it. 4 o'clock, wallow in self-pity. 4:30, stare into the abyss. 5 o'clock, solve world hunger. Tell no one. 5:30, jazzercise. 6:30, dinner with me. I can't cancel that again. 7 o'clock, wrestle with my self-loathing. I'm booked.
Now, Eric, you say you hated this movie when it first came out, but now you like it.
I did hate this movie when it first came out because I was so wedded to the nostalgia for the original, which was, you know, a wonderful half-hour animated special. It was directed by Chuck Jones, who's the classic guy who did a lot of the Looney Tunes stuff. And it had Boris Karloff as the perfect narrator slash Grinch. So let's listen to a little bit of that.
I know just what to do. The Grinch laughed in his throat. I'll make a quick Santa Claus hat to the coat. He chuckled and clucked. What a great Grinchy trick. With this coat and this hat, I'll look just like St. Nick.
Now, that was done back in 1966, right? So it's been around for a while. What I didn't appreciate, and what I grew to appreciate every year as sort of my nostalgia started to fade for the old Grinch, is that Jim Carrey inhabited the Grinch in a way that I don't think any other actor could. He really became this character and had so much fun, again, with that idea of giving you a lot of funny stuff at face value, but also doing a lot of meta commentary on the whole notion of a Grinch or the whole notion of a Whoville and how they celebrate Christmas. You're brought along on this ride with him that if you let yourself take it and you don't get too wrapped up in the nostalgia for the original, you can really enjoy it. There's a lot of flaws in the 2000 movie, but Jim Carrey's performance is really amazing, and it gets better for me. I mean, my girlfriend doesn't even like to watch the movie with me because I will literally parrot every line as he says it.
That's Eric Deggans, also known as the Grinch, NPR's TV critic. Eric, thanks so much.
My schedule wouldn't allow it.
Ford announced this week that it's moving its autonomous vehicle production units from Dearborn, Michigan to Detroit, and that the new facility will be up and running next year. Ford is just one of many, including Tesla, Apple, and Google, getting into driverless cars. And now you can add the U.S. military to that list. Kevin Lavery of WKAR in East Lansing, Michigan, reports.
The Blue Water Bridge soars more than 200 feet above the St. Clair River near its mouth at the southern tip of Lake Huron. Thousands of people traverse this 6,000-foot span between the United States and Canada every day. Crossing a bridge like this can be a little unsettling, even for an experienced driver. But what if you could make the trip with your foot off the gas and your hands off the wheel? It's possible. And on a warm fall day, the U.S. Army came to the Michigan side of the bridge to prove it. In Port Huron, four tractor trailers idle along the riverbank. Two are commercial rigs, two are military. Three will be driven by a live person. The real action will happen in truck number four. That's where Paul Rogers will be. He's the director of TARDEC, the Tank Automotive Research, Development, and Engineering Center based near Detroit.
The last vehicle will be, we will have people in it. I'm going to be in it with a driver. Well, he's not going to be touching anything. He's not allowed to touch anything. And we will be following the other three vehicles completely autonomously.
Autonomously. In other words, self-driving. TARDEC is working with the state of Michigan and Auburn University to demonstrate what it calls truck platooning. Riding in a convoy, the three lead vehicles will relay speed, steering, and braking data to the fourth truck, the follower. There's a lot of factors driving the Army's driverless vehicle program. Fuel efficiency is one. There's no human behind the wheel to get tired and cause an accident. And on the battlefield, a supply convoy is a prime target for attack. Autonomous vehicle technology could put fewer soldiers in those trucks. The formation pulls out, heading for the bridge on-ramp. As a reporter, I'm not allowed to ride along. So while I wait for the trucks to come back, I ask Bernard Tyson to explain the hardware. He's a program manager with TARDEC.
What we've done in this vehicle is we've actually put an electronic power steering column on. For the autonomy package, we've then put on additional sensors, some LIDAR, some cameras.
LIDAR stands for Light Detection and Ranging, a laser-based sensor used to measure distance. It's the same principle bats use with sonar. After about an hour, the convoy returns. TARDEC director Paul Rogers emerges from the rear truck, pleased but low-key.
No surprises, which is what we expected and what we needed out of this. So it was very good.
Kirk Steidel, the director of the Michigan Department of Transportation, is clearly impressed.
It was really interesting. We got to the customs plaza on the U.S. side, and it's in automated mode the whole time, and the steering wheel's doing these, you know, quick little adjustments. But as the truck would veer across, you'd see the back tires cross a paint line, and then you'd realize your tires went exactly in the same spot. So where that front truck went is where we went. It was amazing.
Army officials believe autonomous vehicles have the power to radically transform how the military does business in the 21st century. TARDEC is on schedule to roll out 150 more autonomous vehicles for the U.S. Army over the next 2 years. For Here and Now, I'm Kevin Lavery.
Judicial nomination hearings don't often go viral, and Matthew Spencer Peterson probably wishes his hadn't. Peterson is one of President Trump's nominees to become a district judge on the U.S. District Court for D.C. The video that went viral showed Peterson struggling to answer basic questions about the law posed by Republican Senator John Kennedy of Louisiana. We're going to listen now to the first minute of that exchange.
Have any of you not tried a case to verdict in a courtroom, Mr. Peterson? Have you ever tried a jury trial?
I have not.
Civil?
No.
Criminal?
No.
Bench?
No.
State or federal court?
I have not.
Okay. Have you ever taken a deposition?
I was involved in taking depositions when I was associate at Wiley Ryan when I first came out of law school. But that was...
Have you ever, how many depositions?
I would, I'd be struggling to remember.
Less than 10?
Yes.
Less than 5?
Probably somewhere in that range.
Have you ever tried taken a deposition by yourself?
I believe no.
Okay. Have you ever argued a motion in state court?
I have not.
Let's bring in Dahlia Lithwick, who covers the courts for Slate and hosts the podcast Amicus. Hi, Dahlia.
Hey there, Jeremy.
And have you ever tried a case to verdict? And I'm not going to go there with you, but how unusual was that?
It was the longest 5 minutes, not only in the life of the nominee, but for all of us watching it. It was excruciating. I should tell you, under the radar, you know, this has been happening. Trump has broken all land speed records in terms of putting up nominees, doing what he did at this hearing, you know, having 2, 3, 4 stacked at a time. So there's no time to vet, no time to question. So this has been going on. I think what we saw in this particular moment was a materialization of sort of the worst version of what we've actually been seeing happening since inauguration, which is putting up very young, not qualified nominees and then mashing them through in the hopes that the Republicans would confirm anybody.
Well, as you said, it was a troubling 5 minutes. We only played 1 minute of it. I want to just listen to a bit more. This is later in the hearing when Kennedy quizzed Peterson on some legal principles. Let's listen.
Well, as a trial judge, you're obviously going to have witnesses.
Yes.
Can you tell me what the Daubert standard is?
Senator Kennedy, I don't have that readily at my disposal, but I would be happy to take a a closer look at that.
Okay.
That is not something that I've had to contend with.
Do you know what a motion in limine is?
Yes, I haven't. My background is not in litigation as when I was replying to Chairman Grassley. I haven't had to, do a deep dive. And I understand, and I appreciate this line of questioning. I understand the challenge that would be ahead of me if I were fortunate enough to become a district court judge.
Now, Dahlia, I don't know what the Daubert standard is, but then again, I'm not trying to become a federal judge. Are these things that federal judge nominees should know?
Yeah, I think that, some of these, as you go through the rest of the agonizing colloquy, there are some questions he asks about abstention doctrine that maybe all of us don't remember, even if we went to law school. Daubert is actually one of the things that I think if you took any evidence class, you at least know ballpark what it is. A motion in limine, I think if you watch Law and Order, you kind of know what that is. So some of these are feel pretty egregious. Some of them are harder. But I think that general sense that he had absolutely no idea, and I think David French at the National Review said didn't think he needed to study for the test.
Well, and
I think that's the problem.
If people are listening to him and saying, "Who is this guy?" He's the chair of the Federal Election Commission right now.
Yeah, no, this is a very, very high power person. He's been doing an awful lot at the FEC to try to refuse and decline to force campaign finance laws. So he's a player. But I think that, again, there's this sense undergirding a lot of these Trump nominees. We remember this from Ben Carson and Betsy DeVos, that if anybody could do it, maybe we should just put up anybody. And I think that the sense that that's starting to infect judicial nominations is really what's in evidence here.
What are the qualifications for becoming a federal judge? And is it common for someone, even before President Trump, to be nominated for a federal judgeship who has no trial experience?
I think the ABA, their standard is they want you to have 12 years of legal experience, of meaningful legal experience. We are now seeing folks who've had 1 year, 2 years. This is, I think, the first time where we're seeing nominees who've never set foot in a courtroom, never argued a motion. So I think that somewhere between what the ABA's blue sky, minimum of 12 years and what we're seeing, which is zero, that's a big, big change. It is partly a function, Jeremy, of the fact that they're putting up people who are 35 and 36. And partly, I think, a function of the fact that they're putting up people who are coming up through political offices and not through any legal offices. So those things are really radically new, I think.
And Chuck Grassley of Iowa, the Republican who chairs the Senate Judiciary Committee, said on Wednesday that the Senate would reject two controversial judicial nominees, Jeff Mateer and Brett Talley. What can you tell us about them?
Again, very young. Brett Talley was up for the district court in Alabama, 36 years old, never tried a case. ABA had unanimously called him unqualified. Then it turned out he'd forgotten to disclose that he was married to the White House counsel's chief of staff. He never disclosed that. Then it turned out he'd written thousands of blog posts celebrating things like, quote, the early KKK and telling people who were not gun control advocates that they were wimps. So he got himself in trouble at his hearings by not only not disclosing, but I think also by being a little smug. Jeff Mateer, again, has this kind of harrowing history of having said things, most famously, that transgender children are, quote, Satan's plan, and that same-sex marriage equals debauchery. So these are folks, again, this is Republicans on the committee have put through and seated bloggers. I mean, we've had other bloggers come through who've written equally shocking things. So Grassley drawing the line in the sand at Talley and Mateer is interesting, but it is a line in the sand. These folks, we thought 2 weeks ago, were shoo-in.
Well, and they were rejected, as you say, but Leonard Stephen Graz was confirmed to the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals by a party-line vote, despite the fact that the American Bar Association rated him not qualified. What do we know about him, and how unusual is that?
That was another very, very controversial nominee, Jeremy. He got in by a vote of 50 to 48. For the ABA to name somebody unqualified, it's only happened three times since 1989, and that's through 17,000 nominees is the data I'm looking at. And when Obama's two nominees were called unqualified by the ABA, they were pulled back. So to have somebody Gratz had written, again, radically anti-Roe v. Wade, anti-same-sex marriage, looks like there were temperament issues that the ABA found. Nevertheless, he was pushed through, and the claim on the Judiciary Committee from the Republicans is that the ABA is a liberal hack enterprise and that all 200 lawyers who were interviewed were biased. So we're seeing the sidelining of what used to be seen as nonpartisan institutions as part of the vetting process. Now they're all being called biased and noms are getting through.
And these stumbles notwithstanding, it does seem like President Trump is getting his judicial nominees through the Senate faster than certainly President Obama.
That's right. I think that now we have now broken all records this week when the 12th Circuit Court nominee, so that's the appeals court, the federal appeals court, got through to a seat. We've now broken the records of Nixon and JFK, who had seated 11 nominees in their first year. Obama only got three, Jeremy, right, in his first year. So we're, like I said, land speed records are being shattered.
So do you think that Peterson, who we heard from in the beginning there in that questioning, is going to make it through?
I think he hurt himself, and I think he actually, having Senator John Kennedy from Louisiana, a Republican who, as I said, voted from some other controversial nominees, even after saying he didn't like the bloggers, he didn't like the attitude.
Right.
So for John Kennedy to flip, I think you're seeing the beginning of a really interesting fissure there.
That's Dahlia Lithwick, who writes about the law for Slate and hosts the podcast Amicus. Dahlia, thank you.
Always a pleasure.
And we've been circling back to people we've spoken with this past year who lived through some of its spasms, shootings, wildfires, hurricanes. Today, the 19-year-old reporter we spoke with after Hurricane Irma, after we saw the incredible video of her broadcasting from Radio Anguilla as the Category 5 storm hammered that island, you could hear storm shutters flapping as she tried to reassure listeners.
We are doing the best that we can. We're operating here on a generator, and we are experiencing stuff. But
we are here for you. She told us shortly after that that the listeners' calls stayed with her.
This one man, I'll never forget what it sounded like speaking to him. He had a baby in the room, and his shutters were being blown out. And it's like, what do we do next?
Well, we have reached Nisha Dupuis again on this British territory, which depends on tourism. And Nisha, it's still being restored?
Hi, Robin. Well, what I can say for certain is that the people of Anguilla has proven to be quite resilient. We do operate on a single economy, tourism, and we were able to reopen for this tourist season. Some resorts are still not opened, but for the most part, it's definitely looking up. We've come a long way since Irma.
Well, we remember at the time, Cardigan Carner, who is the Parliamentary Secretary for Tourism, said how bittersweet it was because earlier in the year, there had been such visitor growth, up 21% from the U.S. alone. You were on track for a record year for tourism, and then September 6th kicked in everything. Windows, doors, roofs, homes, electricity, roads, businesses, hotels. Even your ferry terminal there was demolished. Which of the hotels, because there's so many famous ones, the Four Seasons, which is open?
Well, Zemi and Four Seasons, some of the major hotels have dedicated to opening next year. We have about 30 small hotels and villas and guest houses that are opened or at least committed to open for this festive season in December. And Irma did definitely cripple the economy. But fortunately, we were able to get £60 million from the British government that will go towards rebuilding the ferry terminal, rebuilding the airport and other infrastructure that was damaged.
Well, we know there was a death on your island, four deaths in the Caribbean. And you've got St. Martin, which is a neighboring island, you know, devastated, much of the housing and the hotel rooms gone, you know, when this happened. What about the traumatic effect of this?
It has definitely been traumatizing. A lot of people are still remembering. They're still having they can still remember. It's something that they hold dear. And a lot of people are saying that this is by far the worst hurricane that they've ever experienced. Being off the island for a little while and coming back, I get to see a fresh kind of outlook. But definitely the stories are still ongoing. It's still the major conversation here on the island, and just trying to figure out how everyone was doing, how everyone survived. We're 85% electrified, the island, mm-hmm. And hopefully in the next 3 to 5 days we'll be able to have island-wide electricity. But we were, so you can understand that it's been a very trying time. People are still without electricity. Unfortunately, the students are still on a shift system at the high school, but of course with the £60 million grant, the chief minister said that for sure funds will go towards rebuilding the high school.
But are there people talking about leaving?
It was quite interesting to see that a lot of people had made the decision to move off into the UK, but primarily because a lot of people are dependent on the hotel jobs. But we're hopeful that by next year, when most of the reconstruction starts to happen, that a lot of people will, of course, come back home and we can all work together to rebuild the economy.
How about you? I mean, you became an international star. Did you think of maybe leaving yourself?
Well, for me, it was more less to do with Hurricane Irma and more to do with always being desirous of pursuing my education in journalism. But for now, I will be on Anguilla for some time until it's possible for me to be able to attend a university. But I am definitely working on a blog, and I am an aspiring talk show host. So I'm not sure where I may be in the next future, but I do hope it will be somewhere where I'm doing what I love.
Well, it would be the industry's gain. So we wish you all the best in that.
Thank you.
I still can't believe your composure when you were broadcasting during that storm. That's Nisha Dupuy, the 19-year-old journalist and student from Anguilla. Nisha, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Robin.
And we'll have a link to Hurricane Relief for Anguilla at hereandnow.org. Hey, Jeremy, are you feeling a certain sadness looming?
It's somebody's last day.
Yeah, Savannah Marr, our new assistant at NPR in Washington, D.C., leaving.
And Savannah has been a great producer, a great idea generator for the show, and she's worked with us and Eric Deggans every week. So, Savannah, great job. We will miss you and thank you.
Well, and something tells me we'll be hearing about her again. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.